Well, I'm in over my head, no one told me. Trying to keep my footprint small was harder than I thought it could be. I'm in over my head, what do I really need? Trying to save the planet, oh, will someone please save me? Trying to save the planet, oh, will someone please save me?
Welcome to In Over My Head. I'm Michael Bartz. For this season, I'll be exploring the Old Man Watershed, located in my home community of Southern Alberta. Recently, we faced concerns around water security related to climate change. I want to talk about what's going on and how we can adapt. So I sat down with environmental experts, city employees, business owners, and everyday people to learn as much as I could about why our watershed matters and how we can protect it. To start, I want to go over some of the basics. So I talked with someone who knows all about our watershed.
Hello, my name's Shannon Frank. I'm the executive director of the Old Man Watershed Council. A watershed is an area of land that drains into a single water body. And a watershed can be at any different scale. So you might have a small watershed that drains into a nearby pond. And you might call that, you know, Shannon's Pond Watershed. And then if you keep getting bigger and bigger, we have, the Crow's Nest River Watershed, the Willow Creek Watershed, and all of those major rivers flow into the Old Man River. And so then we call that larger area the Old Man River Watershed, which then flows across Saskatchewan into Manitoba and into Lake Winnipeg and out to Hudson's Bay. So at the larger scale, we're also part of the Hudson's Bay Watershed. So in our watershed, it starts in the mountains. Most of our major rivers start in the mountains, not all. Some rise in the Porcupine Hills or even on the prairie. But ours mostly do start in the mountains. And then, yeah, like they flow downstream through different tributaries into the Old Man River. And so it's literally based on the geography of the land. Any, you know, if you picture any sort of hill or mountain, on one side of the mountain, the water flows that way. And the other side, it's going to flow the opposite way. That's what the continental divide is with British Columbia. And so the rivers literally flow opposite directions. And about 90% of the water in the Old Man River comes from those mountain headwaters. The prairie streams and some of the smaller streams contribute very little.
And the Old Man River, I guess it's connected to Lethbridge and then just all around Southern Alberta as far as the different towns?
It goes by the actual rise and fall of the land. So it's a very irregular shape, but it starts roughly around High River in the north and goes across eastwards towards Tabor. It joins the Bow River at Grassy Lake. So that's the eastern boundary. And then in the southern boundary is actually the States. The St. Mary River and actually starts in the States in Glacier National Park and flows through the Blackfeet Nation. And we have, we benefit a lot from that protection of that river. And that's one of our most productive rivers. I think it's around 19% of the water in the Old Man comes from the St. Mary River. And then, of course, the continental divide with British Columbia is the western border. So, yeah, it's a good size. It's 28,000 square kilometers.
Is there anything that makes the Old Man Watershed unique for this area?
Well, it's one of the more biodiverse areas. That's why Waterton Lakes National Parks was established, because there's a lot of biodiversity there. And it's unique in that it's where the prairies kind of smashes right up against the mountains. There's not like a big foothills area in between like you see further north, where we have the Porcupine Hills and there's more gradual geography. And also that's why the Castle Parks was established, because it's one of the more intact landscapes that's left in the southwest area. And so it was protected a few years ago. One thing that might be very interesting for you with the climate topic is the Old Man Watershed. I was told by Dr. Dave Sochin at the University of Regina, who's a renowned climatologist, that we're actually the most volatile, variable climate outside of a couple places in Siberia. like in terms of our highs and lows with like the minus 30 and the plus 30, you know, it's very extreme. And so we do have that extreme climate to tend with already. It's proven over what he uses tree rings to see what was the climate and the moisture situation, the river flows over the past 1,000 years. He can look through these tree rings, and we can see through that there's been 50-year droughts around here. There's been colossal floods, way bigger than anything we've seen, way bigger than the 95 flood that everybody, you know, talks about, is kind of baked into our history as the one. You know, we've had very extreme climate here for the past 1,000 years, and now with climate change and global warming, that's going to get even more extreme, which is a little scary.
And I guess with these changes in the climate, I'm thinking there's going to be, maybe more floods or more droughts. So how would that affect our local watershed?
Well, our watersheds are, more equipped to deal with it. Our natural ecosystems are very resilient. They're used to dealing with that extreme climate. You know, I'm more worried about the humans. We're not equipped. We're not ready. And certainly we've degraded some of our watersheds, so those areas are more vulnerable. And, you know, that's why we spend a lot of our time and money on restoring ecosystems, trying to build that resiliency so they can withstand floods and droughts and support us to withstand them. So that's where we get our water from. And then this year, we're in kind of our third year of drought. We're having these bad seasonal droughts where, we might get some spring rain or some decent snowpack, but by July and certainly into August, it's really dry and really bad, really low flows. We're seeing a lot of creeks and rivers dried up, dugouts are empty, groundwater wells have dropped, and there's just not enough water for cattle or for crops, and the grass isn't growing because it's so dry, so there's nothing for the cattle to eat. That means that the trees and the shrubs and the grasses are very stressed too, you know, they're probably not growing. They're probably either going dormant and saving their energy for next year, hoping for some precipitation. That's what plants generally do. Most of them, or, you know, some of them can go dormant to save energy and water. So that's what they do. And so they have less food to eat. They have less water to drink. And certainly if you're a fish in one of those creeks or rivers that dried up, then you're toast.
And I guess when you say you're working on protecting these areas, repairing them, you know, keeping the biodiversity going, I guess, does that make your job more difficult if there are more floods or droughts or, you know, those different changes? Or is it kind of the same as before, because we've had a lot of that here?
No, it's actually very difficult to restore areas because we have to now water it. You know, there isn't enough precipitation to water the plants, because a lot of restoration is based on planting native grasses, native shrubs, trees, willows, and they need water to get established. And so now we're having to water them and irrigate them to make sure they can survive. And so it adds another layer of complexity, who's going to water them? How we have to pump water from somewhere or drive it in a tank from somewhere, or, you know, it's very difficult. So, an ounce of prevention is definitely the best situation we could have, is to keep these areas intact, because once they're degraded and we have to start replanting, it's a mammoth effort.
Has that actually happened? We've had to actually bring water in to water things?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We're very limited here what restoration techniques we can use. So one thing we do a lot of is we bury willow stakes in the ground in wet areas, because then they have a chance. If we're planting trees, we can use the tree diapers that kind of slowly leak out water, but then you have to refill the diaper every week. So it's a lot more work, and then you have to have the staff to do that or the volunteers to do that. Like, we can't just go plant trees and be like, oh, they'll be fine, it'll rain, because it won't. You know, it's just, it's very stressful for the environment and the plants and the animals and all of our wild neighbors. They're not doing well when there's a drought. You know, we haven't experienced this recently. Like, the Dirty 30s was where we had kind of the last really severe, major, widespread drought. And we haven't had that in a while. We've had more of these kind of localized droughts where we're surviving year to year just with the snowpack melting. But we're at the point now this year where our reservoirs are fairly low now, because we've had to, you know, take out the water to irrigate the land, because otherwise nothing will grow. And so if we can't refill those reservoirs next spring with a good snowpack, if we don't get enough snow, we're going to be in a really bad situation. So everything right now kind of depends on that annual snowpack, and hoping that we get enough to fill those reservoirs and get us through another year.
If we didn't get enough snow, then what would happen?
Well, the reservoirs wouldn't fill. They would be low or empty or whatever situation, depending on the amount. And then irrigators wouldn't be able to irrigate. And that's 90% of the water is used for your agricultural irrigation to grow our crops. And a lot of that, those crops are grown to feed the cattle. The industries are very related, cattle and crops here. Not all, but a good portion. And so it would really impact our agricultural-based economy. We would see, you know, prices go up, people getting laid off. And we can probably get through a year or two, but then farmers start having to, decide, are we going to sell our land? Are we going to wait a couple of years and hope that the drought goes away? Like, what do you do? You're in a pickle. And like I mentioned earlier, we have had long-term droughts of, you know, 10-year droughts, 20-year droughts, 50-year droughts. That's what scares me when I look at those tree rings and the data, and I see that, you know, that's really scary. It is in the back of everyone's mind who works in the kind of agri-environmental sectors. Like, how do we prepare for this? How do we stop this? And there's lots of things happening to prepare, but some of it you can't prepare for.
And what sort of things are they doing to prepare?
Well, for example, there's a big effort goes into breeding crops that are drought resilient, so they need much less water, but they still need some. I mean, all plants need some water. So that's a big one that has actually saved a ton of water over the years. Like, these drought resilient crops are amazing. And then, you know, so the irrigation districts, kind of what they do is they adjust their the amount of water they give out to the farmers based on the supply. So they're really good at adapting each year to say, okay, we only have this much water this year, so we can only give out this much. You know, they are well aware of the situation each year, and they are very careful to adjust their numbers. So that's one big thing. But I think in some ways we're having like a bit of an environmental awakening, where we're starting to realize we can't do things the way we used to do them. We're in a whole new world now with global warming and climate change, where what we did in the past doesn't work. And like, it literally is a whole new world. We've never had a world this hot where we've had humans living. We've never had a world with this type of weather. So we have to, you know, get rid of our old thinking and really focus on innovation and adapting. And you see this more with like the younger crowd. They have like a very new, different perspective of like, why isn't this happening? Like, I thought this was the way it should be. Like, we protect the environment first, and you know, that doesn't make sense to me. Like, we work with students from the university and college, and they ask a lot of questions, but like, they don't understand why is this happening? Like, what is going on? Like, why isn't the environment the first thing that we think of to protect our clean air and our clean water and our soil? And so I see a lot of hope. I think humans are like very smart and resilient and adaptable, and we're going to change very quickly, whether we like it or not, because we're very good at changing when we have to, and it's getting to the point where we have to. And so I think there's going to be like big changes happening very quickly, and you know, it'll be hopefully for the better, where we'll see more of a focus on that foundation. The environment is our foundation.
Next, I would learn exactly how our climate has changed over the decades in Alberta and what we can expect in the future.
Hi, my name is Stefan Kienzle. I'm professor emeritus at the University of Lethbridge, and I was working at the Department of Geography and Environment. When we talk about climate change in the media, they talk about this 1.5 degrees warmer, and this means nothing for the average person. The average person says 1.5 degrees warmer. That's great. I don't mind it being a bit warmer. What's wrong with that, right? But I wanted to look behind the data. And so when we talk about climate change, it's always about these big averages that are completely meaningless. And I said, let's put some sense into the data. And so basically, when you picture a graph of daily temperature, and then you can basically, from this graph, for this one location, you can say, well, how many days over 30 degrees did I have? How many frost days did I have? How many days below 18, which is basically when you turn your heater on? How many days above 21, when you typically turn your air conditioner on? Those kind of things. And so I basically could do this for each year of my data. And if I have 68 years of this data set, now I can have a time series. I have a trend. How was this in the 1950s compared to today? And so I could do this eventually. I did this for 55 different climate indices. So let's take again this example of days over 30 degrees, which of course is something we're experiencing actually right these days. So if you look back in Calgary, for instance, in the 1950s, you had on average 2 days per year that was over 30 degrees. Well, now we have that for weeks without interruption. So obviously the climate has very, very much changed. And so then I provided this data set. And once I had this data set with all this information, and we just had this discussion in the lab, and we said, hey, we can map this. And why don't we map it in a way that it's available for all Albertans? And then for me, it's one of those rare things in life, the stars kind of aligned, because I had a knock on my office door, and Christine is standing in the doorframe. And Christine was a media student who was a brilliant, as it turned out, web designer, and she was looking for a master's project. And so we had a chat within half an hour. We had it all laid out. We said, you are going to take my climate data and you're going to make that into an interactive website that then is available to all Albertans. And we worked on this thing then for a year and a half together, and it was hard work. We had to solve a lot of little hurdles. But at the end of the day, this is the site that is online. AlbertaClimateRecords.com is a site that she is still hosting. And we made one update about, I think, 4 or 5 years later. So the latest version only goes up to 2017. We haven't had the chance to update the data yet. But the message is very, very clear, right? So if you dive into the data and you ask yourself, well, how has my climate changed and how does it impact me in my own backyard, right? So when you look at growing season has lengthened by between 2 and 5 weeks per year. So that is significant. So that means that for the farmers and for the ranchers, they have a bit more leeway early in the spring and later in the fall of when to seed or when to put the harvest in. But all that comes, of course, also with the trouble of climate change and the impacts. Other things sort of that was really surprising for me was you expected that we have more heat waves. And heat waves in Alberta have between doubled and fourfolded right across Alberta. So way, way more of these heat waves that we're all experiencing now. But what was a big surprise for me was also that cold spells have also doubled 2 quadrupled in the same time period. And that was something that I didn't expect with climate warming. How can we have more cooling areas? But this is a thing that climate change, and I think we all have experienced this, especially in the last 4 or 5 years, is that we are going from a normal summer day to extreme heat and then to extreme cold, a real cold front is coming. Remember, just a few years ago, we had 60 centimeters of snow in September, which was really hard for the farmers and the ranchers and just us house owners or traffic users and all this. And so that was a big surprise. So it really is the climate extremes going from one extreme, an extreme heat wave, to then straight to a cold spell. And we have read about this in the media all around Canada and abroad, of course, that a region experiences a drought and forest fires, and it's just horrible. Everything is dry. And then comes the flood. Then comes the rain, and they have way too much rain. And it goes from really from one extreme to the other extreme. And a flood event after a rain, after a forest fire, is one of the worst things that can happen. It is horrible because there's a very interesting thing about carbon, about the black stuff that's on the ground. It's ash. It's just wooden residue, right? And carbon is hydrophobic. So if you take your garden hose and sprinkle it over a burned area, it would not infiltrate. It would just basically build a water bubble on top of that carbon and not infiltrate, and then basically eventually just run off on the surface. And if you have a downpour, you know, a good thunderstorm over a burned area, that means the water can't infiltrate into the ground and then later come out slowly as groundwater and feed the rivers. Instead, it just accumulates on the ground and runs off. And when it's run off, it then concentrates in certain areas, in the low-lying areas. It erodes into the ground, and it removes the topsoil. It removes the nutrient layer, the very rich layer that maintains the forest for dozens and hundreds of years. And so basically, a rainfall after a forest fire, after a wildfire, means we have a lot of soil erosion. And that erosion ends up in the river, causing a whole bunch of water quality issues. And of course, it's gone for the area that wants to regrow a forest again. And so that has major impacts. So we are living at a time where we go from one extreme to the next extreme. Everything from forest fires to droughts to floods to windstorms to hailstorms, they all have increased. And we have to learn how to live with this. The sad thing is, and I think we all, again, also experience that, is there's really no place in Canada or anywhere else on the planet where you can hide from these extreme weather events. And so no matter where you are, there are certain events that you have to anticipate. And that means we have to just simply prepare for that. I mean, I prepared, for instance, for increased hailstorms. And I experienced it here where within 11 days, I had 2 hailstorms where you had over golf ball size hail. And my yard back home in Lethbridge was basically defoiled. So I had hardly any leaves left on my trees. And of course, I had damage to my roof, and I had damage to my fences and other things. And so I have rebuilt a stronger roof. I have better tiles on my roof. Right, I'm insulating my home. I make sure that my house is well insulated, so that I don't need too much heating in the winter and too much cooling in the summer. My air conditioner only jumped in twice this year, and I'm proud of that because obviously my insulation work has helped me to reduce that electricity cost. And so there are things that we can all do in order to reduce our carbon footprint, to just prepare for what's about to come in terms of extreme weathers. A lot of people, when they think about climate change, they're saying, that's a future thing. Climate change is a future thing. It's a present thing. We're living it. We're right in it. The last 5 years have all had very extreme weathers. right? So we're right now in a drought. Our reservoirs are dry. We have water restriction advisories, not enforced yet in Lethbridge, but I think they should enforce them. I think the public should be more aware of this. I believe the same thing how we get warned about extreme events like extreme thunderstorm warning. We also should get warnings about droughts because drought is being monitored by our governments. We have various ways how to measure drought and how to index drought and saying this is a severe drought versus a not so severe drought. And I think we're heading to a potentially very severe drought when you look at farmers are putting in their harvests weeks earlier than normal. And dryland farmers have often nothing to harvest because it was just way too dry and too hot for the crops to do any meaningful yields for them. Big, big problems. The irrigation reservoirs are basically empty. There is not much left, and basically they have already announced that they will stop supplying irrigation water to the irrigators earlier this year because they're running out of water. When I looked at my climate change website and established those numbers, I not only looked at the average change in temperature, I looked at the change in temperature in winter, summer, spring, and fall. And the winter temperatures have increased by far the most. So the winters are getting much, much warmer than they used to. The winters are getting shorter. And when the winters are shorter, that means there's less time for winter snowpack to accumulate and grow and build this good, lush snowpack that can then run off. Also, what happens, of course, with a warming winter is we have more precipitation falling as rain in the winter than as snow. So when you have precipitation falling as rain, that runs off into the river. And so that means our rivers are actually higher in stream flow now in the winter than they used to be. But that comes at a big price that the river flow in the summer and especially in the late summer and fall, are extremely low. Right now, the Old Man River is very, very shallow. And that is simply the result of lack of precipitation and the lack of last year's snowpack, which would keep the summer flows running if there would have been enough. But there hasn't been enough. It runs off. It melted off and it went into the river and ran off in the spring. And now there's little water left for us. So that means the whole dynamic of the watershed has changed in the last decades. And that is something that also we need to adapt to. If you were someone who wants to pump water out of a river, well, you have to prepare that the river runs dry by the end of the year.
During this conversation, I learned a new term, flash drought.
So a flash drought is like a flash flood, is an unforeseen event that comes very suddenly. And a flash drought is simply when you have a heat dome over an area for long enough, for a few weeks, that it basically sucks the moisture out of the soil. And the soil is big, which was fine before, but now it is so dry that you can't grow crops on this anymore. And so then you go from a normal situation to a drought situation within a few weeks. And that, of course, freaks the farmers out because that's something that can happen anytime, anywhere. And it is happening in our areas. And that's why our farmers are, they're in trouble. If you're not an irrigator, if you're a dryland farmer, you rely on what nature provides you from above. And if you're an irrigation farmer, you rely on what happens in the mountains. So they watch the mountains versus you as a dryland farmer, you just watch the sky. And if that's not providing you with the goodies that you want, then we go back to the dirty 30s, you know, the Dust Bowl areas. And that is something that I mention regularly to my students, is that this is the biggest threat that Southern Alberta has, is another Dust Bowl. It's just a matter of time when it comes. Statistically speaking, in a way, we are actually overdue with a drought. And a drought with climate change on top of that is going to be pretty disastrous. The problem why a drought is so disastrous is not only basically the irrigation farmers, once the irrigation dams are out of water, well, You have no more water to irrigate with. The dryland farmers are probably just watching their crop do nothing. The ranchers with their herds, they don't know where to get the feed from. We have to all be reminded that roughly 50% of the grains we are growing, both dryland and irrigated, are going for feed to the ranchers. So if we can't grow enough food, we don't have enough feed for the ranchers. That means they have to cull the herds or truck in the grain from somewhere else. And hay bales are very expensive and very heavy. So there's only a limited distance from which you can then import, for instance, hay for feed. And so when you have an area, let's say southern Alberta is under drought, and that may spread into Saskatchewan and maybe other areas as well. So now everyone is without feed. Everyone is in the same problem. And we now have to start culling herds. And if you start doing that, you can't bring those herds back up quickly in a year again. So that means all these things, the drought would have a multi-year effect on the producers. And when the soil is bone dry, it takes a really big several large rainfall events to replenish that soil moisture storage. And if they stay away, well, then the soil keeps being dry and is basically not being able to be managed by the farmers.
I wonder about, you know, like if we are adapting to these changes and if it requires policy, if it requires, you know, individual action. Do you feel like those kinds of changes could be made in time for what, you know, what that future climate might look like if it's getting more extreme or it's getting hotter and shorter winters? Do you have any concerns about that, like as far as adapting appropriately as the climate changes?
I'm very worried that we're not adapting fast enough. And I think the adaptation process, the first thing is that you aware of an issue, aware of a problem, that it is becoming a problem. I said, I have a problem and I will have to deal with it. So we are already living, as we said earlier, in an area where climate change is happening. We live in already, I think, pretty extreme climate events every year all around us. When you look at what we can expect in the future is that the future will not be prettier. The future will be more extreme than what we observe today. We will have more floods, more droughts, more extreme events than we can observe right now. And so this is something that is the new normal. That is just how it's going to be. And whatever events we witness this year and have to deal with them, well, next year we will have similar events again, maybe more forest fires. So for me, one of the worst days is if it's 35 degrees outside and I can't open my windows at night because we have forest fire smoke and the air quality is too poor. Do I want to cool my house or do I want to breathe in bad air? Those are bad decisions. Either way, there's no good coming out of any side. Or turn my air conditioner on, which I refuse to do, only under extreme conditions. So these are all things that we have to deal with. And I think it has to start then that we are aware of this. I insulate my house. I'm aware of my water consumption. If the city says, hey, we're running out of water, well, then I don't irrigate my lawns. That's fine. I don't have any problems with that. But we need everyone to do the same thing.
Yeah, it seems like there's also a certain amount of forecasting and planning too, right? Especially if there's these knock-on effects and if, you know, you're having droughts and fires and smoke and all these other things happening at the same time, right? It seems like you almost have to, I guess the word that comes to mind for me is like resilience. Like you talk about, like, you know, this is the new normal and things are changing, and that's fine. Obviously, we're trying to make things better and people are trying to do their best. But if things are changing, we need to adapt to that. I guess like when I think about, like you talked about earlier, that kind of, I guess you'd call it maybe a worst case scenario of that, you know, back to the dirty 30s. If, you know, it's okay, we're running out of water. Now we can't grow crops. Now we can't have cattle. Now, like suddenly, like it becomes a much bigger problem than just maybe individuals and reducing their water. So I guess, has your research been used to help with some of that planning, saying that we need to adapt and maybe be more resilient? Has there been reception to that?
Well, my research has basically always been to provide answers to what situation do we have to deal with? Which practical situation do you have to deal with? I did a research project a few years ago where I asked myself, let's look at the two major irrigation reservoirs in southern Alberta, the Old Man Reservoir and the St. Mary's Reservoir. And let's see if under future climate predictions scenarios that we have, will we have the same inflows into those reservoirs? Will those reservoirs run dry more often? And the answer is yes, they will. We lose a lot of water, even if we had the same precipitation in the future, which is going to be more or less on average, we're going to have the same precipitation here in southern Alberta. The biggest problem is that with a warming climate, with higher temperatures, we also have more evaporation. That means water is lost from the reservoirs, lost from the soil, and goes back into the atmosphere. And that water is just gone. And so if you have more loss back into the atmosphere, that means effectively your rainfall is less. And so we have to then deal with less water in an already water-scarce region. And we talked already about weather extremes, about winters that did not provide enough precipitation, and hopefully some winters that do. And so that means, of course, if we have what we call a winter drought followed by a summer drought, well, then the reservoirs have very little inflow. And now we have the situation that we have right now is where the reservoirs are virtually empty. That is something that will happen, unfortunately, more often.
Next time on the Old Man Watershed, I learn about the importance of riparian areas and why lakes are important to watersheds.
Any activities that happen in that watershed, that area of land that drains into a lake, can often be picked up in the lake itself. So lakes become these really kind of focal points on the landscape for environmental change.
Eat Over My Head's The Old Man Watershed season was produced by Michael Bartz in partnership with Environment Lethbridge. Special thanks to all the guests who gave generously of their time and expertise.
I'm trying to save the planet, oh, will someone please save me?
This season was made possible with financial assistance from Land Stewardship Center's Watershed Stewardship Grant, funded by Alberta Environment and Protected Areas. Opinions expressed in this season are those of In Over My Head.